Hello, everyone. It's Amy Poehler, and I am about to read my audiobook, Yes, Please. I'm very excited. And before we begin, I want to let you know that I'm broadcasting from my own personal audio booth that I built at the base of Mount Rushmore 15 years ago. And I built it before I had even written one word, and here I am now reading my book to you. What a country. So, lean back if you're at home. Lean forward if you're in your car, and get ready to hear some amazing voices joining me in this booth today. They include Seth Meyers, Mike Shore, Patrick Stewart, Carol Burnett, Kathleen Turner, and my parents. This is not a joke. I have assembled the best team. Basically, the perfect dinner party guests. Also, the last chapter of this book is read live from the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater in Los Angeles. Enjoy. Let's begin. Here we go. Harper Audio presents Yes, Please by Amy Poehler. This is the author. Hi. For my bold and beautiful boys. Writing is hard. A preface. I like hard work, and I don't like pretending things are perfect. I've learned that about myself. And I don't have any fear of writing. I've been writing my whole life. Stories and plays and sketches and scripts and poems and jokes. Most feel alive and fluid, breathing organisms made better by the people who come into contact with them. But this book has nearly killed me. Because, you see, a book has a cover. They call it a jacket, and that jacket keeps the inside warm so that the words stay permanent and everyone can read your genius thoughts over and over again for years to come. Once a book is published, it can't be changed, which is a stressful proposition for this improviser who relies on her charm. I've been told that I am better in the room and prettier in person. Both these things are not helpful when writing a book. I look forward to a lively book-on-tape session with the hope that Kathleen Turner agrees to play me when I talk about some of my darker periods. One can dream.
Well, if you insist.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's reassuring to have you here.
Amy, it would be my pleasure.
It's clear to me now that I had no business agreeing to write this book. I have a job that keeps me shooting 12 hours a day, plus 2 children under 6. I'm going through a divorce and producing many projects and falling in love and trying to make appointments for cranial massage. All of these things are equally wonderful and horrible and keep me just off balance and busy enough to make spending hours alone writing seem like a terrible idea. Plus, I'm 43, which is smack dab in the middle. I haven't lived a full enough life to look back on, but I'm too old to get by on being pithy and cute. I know enough now to know I know nothing. I'm slugging away every day, just like you. But nonetheless, here we are. I've written a book. You have it. Everyone lies about writing. They lie about how easy it is or how hard it was. They perpetuate a romantic idea that writing is some beautiful experience that takes place in an architectural room filled with leather-bound novels and chai tea. They talk about their morning ritual and how they dress for writing and the cabin in Big Sur where they go to be alone, blah, 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 blah. No one tells the truth about writing a book. Authors pretend their stories were always shiny and perfect and just waiting to be written. The truth is, writing is hard and boring and occasionally great, but usually not. Even I have lied about writing. I've told people that writing this book has been like brushing away dirt from a fossil. What a load of shit. It's been like hacking away at a freezer with a screwdriver. I wrote this book after my kids went to sleep. I wrote this book on subways and on airplanes and in between setups while I shot a television show. I wrote this book from scribbled thoughts I kept in the Notes app on my iPhone and conversations I had with myself in my own head before I went to sleep. I wrote it ugly and in pieces. I tried hard not to be overly dramatic, like when I wrote this poem in social studies when I was 14. When life attacks you from every side, it hurts too much. And the most painless, easiest way out is death. To survive, Even now, I'm attempting to write this preface in the dark while my oldest boy, Archie, sleeps next to me. He's dreaming and talking, and I'm turning down the light on the screen as I write about how hard it is to write. Writing a book is awful. It's lonely, even with Archie beside me and my editors nagging me. During this process, I have written my editor's emails with subject headings such as, "How dare you?" and "This is never going to work," and "Why are you trying to kill me?" Most authors liken the struggle of writing to something mighty and macho, like wrestling a bear. Writing a book is nothing like that. It's a small, slow crawl to the finish line. Honestly, I have moments when I don't even care if anyone reads this book. I just want to finish it. If you are listening to this, it means that I have finished. More likely, it means my editors have told me I can't keep tinkering anymore. I will take this time now to thank you for listening to this and buying it and eventually turning it into a feature film with Kate Winslet, Katy Perry, Katie Couric as the star. Let me offer this apology. Please excuse the self-indulgent preface. I know what I'm doing. I'm presenting a series of excuses as to why you should lower your expectations so that you can be blown away by my sneaky insights about life and work. I'm a grown woman. I know my own tricks. I know how good I am at bemoaning my process and pretending I don't care so that my final product will seem, you know, totally natural and part of my essence and not something I sweated for months and years. One of the things I've learned about me while writing about me is that I'm really onto myself. I have got Amy Poehler's number, I'll tell you. I've also learned that writing topless tends to relax me. Go figure, life's a mystery. While writing this book, I made many mistakes. I kept a copy of Nora Ephron's Heartburn next to me as a reminder of how to be funny and truthful, and all I ended up doing was ignoring my writing and just rereading Heartburn. I also kept a copy of Patti Smith's Just Kids nearby, which was awful because her writing is beautiful and poetic, and how dare she. I also read and reread wonderful books by wonderful women. Rachel Dratch's Girl Walks Into a Bar, Sarah Silverman's Bedwetter, Mindy Kaling's Is Everyone Hanging Out Without Me, Lena Dunham's Not That Kind of Girl, Catlin Moran's How to Be a Woman, and Tina Fey's Bossy Pants. All are superb and infuriating. My dear friend and Parks and Recreation castmate Nick Offerman had the nerve to start and publish his book, Paddle Your Own Canoe, in less time than it took me to write this preface. I congratulated him when he presented it to me, and then I immediately threw it in the garbage. I made other terrible mistakes while I tried to write this book. I asked people who had already finished books for advice, which is akin to asking a mother with a 4-year-old what childbirth is like. All the edges have been rounded and they've forgotten the pain. Their books are finished and in their libraries, so all they end up talking about is how you need to stick to your guns and not let the editors push you around and that your title is important. Stick to my guns. I'm hiding from my editors because I feel so guilty that I haven't worked hard enough and given them something genius or interesting or new. My title is important? Well, then I'm screwed. Because right now I'm vacillating between The Secret 2 and Mosquitoes Love Me, A Woman's Guide to Getting Her Funk On. The only people I can stand to read right now are Pema Chodron, who reminds me that life is messy and everything is a dream, and Stephen King and Anne Lamott, who are two of my favorite writers on writing. But now that I think of it, both of them are funnier than me, so they can tie their 68 books to their ankles and go jump in a lake. Many people suggested ways I could carve out more time for my writing, but none of their suggestions involved the care and consideration of the small children who live in my house. Every book written by men and women with children under the age of 6 should have a sleep-deprived sticker. I could find lots of discussion online about waiting for the muse, but not enough about having to write in between t-ball games. I want more honesty from people who write books while they have small children. I want to hear from people who feel like they have no time. I remember once reading about J.K. Rowling and how she wrote Harry Potter while she was a single mom struggling to make ends meet. You know, we need to hear more stories like that. However, I do need to point out that J.K. never had to write a personal memoir and make it funny and do it while she had to be on camera with makeup on, and she only had one kid at the time, if I remember correctly. I don't know, this could be wrong. Editors, please fact check this. Also, let marketing know that I am very interested in Yes Please becoming the next Harry Potter. In my desperation, I searched out other writers who were struggling and asked them if they wanted to take a break from their own misery and contribute to my book so I would have fewer pages to fill. I thought about asking Hillary Clinton, but realized she was too busy writing, finishing, and publishing her own book. If I had timed it better, I could have contributed to her book and she could have contributed to mine, but I blew it. I guess my essay, Judge Judy, American Hero, will have to be read in Harper's at a later date. Writing this book has been so hard. I wrote a Parks and Recreation script in 3 days. And it was a joy, writing in a voice that wasn't my own. I've also written 2 screenplays in the time it's taken me to crank this sucker out. I mean, this isn't true, but whatever. I can write a screenplay in my sleep, shit. So what do I do? What do we do? How do we move forward when we're tired and afraid? What do we do when the voice in our head is yelling that we are never gonna make it? How do we drag ourselves through the muck when our brain is telling us you are dumb and you will never finish and no one cares and it's time you stop? Well, the first thing we do is we take our brain out and we put it in a drawer. Stick it somewhere and let it tantrum until it wears itself out. You may still hear the brain and all the shitty things it's saying to you, but it'll be muffled. And just the fact that it's not in your head anymore will make things seem clearer. And then you just do it. You just dig in and write it. You use your body. You lean over the computer and stretch and pace. You write and then cook something and write some more. You put your hand on your heart and feel it beating and decide if what you wrote feels true. You do it because the doing of it is the thing. The doing is the thing. The talking and worrying and thinking is not the thing. This is what I know. Writing the book is about writing the book. So, here we go, you and me. Because what else are we going to do? Say no? Say no to an opportunity that may be slightly out of our comfort zone? Quiet our voice because we're worried it's not perfect? I believe great people do things before they are ready. This is America, and I am allowed to have healthy self-esteem. This book comes straight from my feisty and freckled fingers. No, it was a battle. Blood was shed. A war raged between my jokey and protective brain and my squishy and tender heart. I've realized that mystery is what keeps people away, and I've grown tired of smoke and mirrors. I yearn for the clean, well-lighted place. So, let's peek behind the curtain and hail the others like us, the open-faced sandwiches who take risks and live big and smile with all of their teeth. These are the people I want to be around. This is the honest way I want to live and love and write. Except when it comes to celebrities without makeup, I want my celebrities to look beautiful. I don't need to see them pumping gas. I tried to tell the truth and be funny. What else do you want from me, you filthy animals? I love you. Amy. Instructions for how to use this book. This book is a missive from the middle. It's a street-level view of my life so far. It's an attempt to speak to that feeling of being young and old at the same time. I cannot change the fact that I am an American white woman who grew up lower middle class and had children after spending most of her life acting and doing comedy. So if you hate any of those buzzwords, you may want to bail now. Sometimes this book stays in the present. Other times I try to cut myself in half and count the rings. Occasionally I think about the future, but I try to do that sparingly because it usually makes me anxious. This book is an attempt to present an open scrapbook that includes a sense of what I am thinking and feeling right now. But mostly, let's call this book what it really is. An obvious money grab to support my notorious online shopping addiction. I've already spent the advance on fancy washcloths from Amazon, so I need this book to really sell a lot of copies or else I'm in trouble. Chop chop, people. In this book, there's a little bit of talk about the past. There's some light emotional sharing. I guess that's the memoir part. And there's also some advice, which varies in its levels of seriousness. Lastly, there are just essays, which are stories that usually have a beginning and an end, but nothing is guaranteed. Sometimes these three things are mixed together, like a thick stew. I hope it's full of flavor and fills you up, but don't ask me to list all the ingredients. I struggled with choosing a quote that would set the table for you and establish an important tone once you started listening. I thought about Eleanor Roosevelt's, "A woman is like a tea bag. You never know how strong it is until it's in hot water." I dabbled with, "A woman who does not wear perfume has no future," from the seemingly hilarious and real girl's girl, Coco Chanel. I was tempted by, "I always play women I would date," from Angelina Jolie. But Wordsworth stuck with me when he said, "Poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. It takes its origin from emotion recollected in tranquility." I don't know how Wordsworth sounded. I'm just taking a stab here. This book is a spontaneous overflow in the middle of chaos, not tranquility. So it's not a poem to you. It's a half poem. It's a po. It's a polar po. Wordsworth also said that the best part of a person's life is his little, nameless, unremembered acts of kindness and of love. I look forward to reading a book one day in which someone lists mine. I feel like I may have failed to do so. Either way, it's obvious I'm currently on a Wordsworth kick, and this should give you literary confidence as you listen to Yes, Please. The title Yes, Please comes from a few different places. I like to say Yes, Please as an answer to a lot of things in my personal and professional life. The yes comes from my improvisational days and the opportunity that comes with youth, and the please comes from the wisdom of knowing that agreeing to do something usually means you aren't doing it alone. It's called Yes, Please because it's the constant struggle and often the right answer. Can we figure out what we want, ask for it, and stop talking? Yes, please. Is being vulnerable a power position? Yes, please. Am I allowed to take up space? Yes, please. Would you like to be left alone? Yes, please. I love saying yes, and I love saying please. Saying yes doesn't mean I don't know how to say no, and saying please doesn't mean I am waiting for permission. Yes, please sounds powerful and concise. It's a response and a request. It's not about being a good girl. It's about being a real woman. It's also a title I can tell my kids. I like when they say yes, please, because, I don't know, most people are rude, and nice manners are the secret keys to the universe. They are words to live by. Oh, and attention, men, don't despair. There's plenty of stuff in here for you, too. Since I've spent the majority of my life in rooms filled with men, I feel like I know you well. I love you. I love the shit out of you. I think this book will speak to men in a bunch of different ways. And I should also point out that there's a secret code in each chapter, and if you figure it out, it unlocks the next level, and you get better weapons to fight the zombie quarterbacks on the Pegasus Bridge. So get cracking, you task-oriented monkey brains. Oh, I still wish this book was just a compendium of searing photographs I took in Afghanistan during my years as a sexy war correspondent, but hey, there's still time. Shall we? Part 1. Say whatever you want.
Chapter 1. How I Fell in Love with Improv, Boston. I was in fourth grade and in trouble. You know, Amy, I think that you should read this yourself.
Okay, fine. Thank you, Kathleen. How I Fell in Love with Improv, Boston. I was in fourth grade and in trouble. The students of Wildwood Elementary School in Burlington, Massachusetts, shifted in their uncomfortable metal seats as they waited for me to say my next line. A dog rested in my arms, and an entire musical rested on my shoulders. I was playing Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, and it was my turn to speak. Dorothy is Hamlet for girls. Next to Annie and Annie and Sandy in Grease, it's the dream role of every 10-year-old. Annie taught me that orphanages were a blast and being rich is the only thing that matters. Grease taught me that being in a gang is nonstop fun and you need to dress sexier if you have any chance of keeping a guy interested. But The Wizard of Oz was the ultimate. It dealt with friendship and fear and death and rainbows and sparkly red shoes. Up to this moment, I had only been on stage twice. The first was for a winter pageant in second grade. I was dressed as a snowflake and had to recite a poem. The microphone was tilted too high, and so I stood on my tiptoes and fixed it. A year later, I was in a school play in the role of a singing lion. My lion's mane, a dyed string mop worn on my head, kept slipping, and I surreptitiously adjusted it mid-song. My parents would later point to these two small moments and tell me that's when they knew I would be a performer. Honestly, I don't think I had a burning desire to act at that young age. Back then, I didn't know acting was a job, really. All I knew was I liked roller skating in my driveway and making people sit and watch. I liked setting up dance contests in my basement and being the only judge. I liked attention. Attention and control. Attention, control, and it turns out laughs. In The Wizard of Oz, the part of Dorothy isn't exactly the comedic lead. She spends a lot of time listening to other people explain themselves. She's the straight man among a bunch of much juicier character parts. The Wicked Witch of the West is more dynamic. The Scarecrow has a bigger arc. Even the Lollipop Guild has a killer song. Dorothy just asks a lot of questions and is always the last to know. But I didn't care, because at the time I was in fourth grade, which, for me, was a heavenly time to be a girl. It was all elbows and angles and possibility. I hadn't gotten my period or kissed a boy. My beloved grandfather hadn't yet died of a heart attack on my front porch on the 4th of July. I wanted to be an astronaut or a scientist or a veterinarian, and all signs pointed to my making any or all of that happen. The worst things I had encountered to this point were lice, which I'd had, scoliosis, which I didn't, and the threat of nuclear war. A shadow that loomed over everything. My generation was obsessed with scoliosis. Judy Blume dedicated an entire novel to it. It felt like at least once a month we would line up in the gym, lift our shirts, and bend over while some creepy old doctor ran his finger up and down our spines. Nuclear war was a high concept threat, two words that often rang out in political speeches or on the 6 o'clock news. Our spines, lice, nuclear war. The big three. AIDS was just around the corner, but we didn't know it yet. The only AIDS I knew were an unfortunately named caramel diet candy my mom had in our kitchen cabinet. The anxiety-filled 80s would dovetail nicely with my hormonal teenage years, but in fourth grade, in 1980, I felt like I would live forever. I stood on stage in my blue checked dress, Toto in my arms, and looked at the audience of parents, teachers, and students. I breathed in, and I had a huge realization. I could decide right then and there what the next moment would be. I could try something new. I could go off script and give something a shot. I could say whatever I wanted. It was because of this Dorothy moment that I had the nerve years later to try out for the high school musical. It was my senior year, and Burlington High School had been a great place for a floater like me. I weaved in and out of activities and groups and hid on occasion. My school was big and sprawling, with 400 students in my graduating class. I played basketball and soccer for a while, and I thought maybe I might be some kind of athlete. My dad was a semi-pro basketball player in college, and I had inherited his hand-eye coordination. I was a decent point guard and middling fullback. Softball was the most fun because of the opportunity to shit-talk. But my enthusiasm for team sports fell away once I realized I would never be great. Once they move you from shortstop to second base, you might want to start making other plans. I was a cheerleader for a while. I did student council. I started to hang with the popular crowd, but was never considered the prettiest or most interesting. I tended to blend. In my high school yearbook, I was voted third runner-up for most casual. I never figured out if that meant most casual in dress or in overall manner. In any case, I didn't come in first. I guess the two ahead of me wanted it less. Every year, our school put on one musical, and in my senior year, I auditioned for Once Upon a Mattress. I didn't know any of the theater kids by name. My experience with musicals was limited at best. In my sophomore year, my class had taken a trip to New York City and gone to a few Broadway shows. We saw a production of The Fantastics, which I liked, and A Chorus Line, which I loved. The part of Diana Morales spoke to me. I loved that she was short and blue-collar. I love how she stood up to her grumpy and withholding acting teacher, Mr. Karp. I love how she cried when that bastard died, because she felt nothing. So badass. On the same trip, we visited the Empire State Building and the World Trade Center, as well as swinging by 30 Rockefeller Center and taking the SNL studio tour. We pressed our noses against the glass, and watched the SNL cast rehearse. It was 1985, and Anthony Michael Hall and Robert Downey Jr. were on the main stage. I would meet both of them 20 years later. I directed Anthony Michael Hall in a reenactment of 16 Candles for a VH1 program, and I met Robert Downey Jr. in a Hollywood coffee shop, where I pitched him my idea for a little indie film called Iron Man. In Once Upon a Mattress, I was cast as Princess Winifred, a part that had physical set pieces and lots of loud singing. It would be the beginning of my playing a long line of crazy big mouths. Carol Burnett had originated this role on Broadway, and I loved the Carol Burnett show. I loved Carol Burnett. She was funny and versatile and up for anything, but most importantly, I could tell that the ensemble around her loved her. I could tell that she was the benevolent captain of that team and was having a hell of a time. Watching that show proved that good comedy can be fun, and you don't have to treat people badly to be on top. I felt the same when I watched Gilda Radner, Andrea Martin, and Catherine O'Hara. You could tell that the cast adored them. You could see Bill Murray look at Gilda in a way that told you he loved her for real. I was lucky enough to meet and do an interview with Carol Burnett once for TV Guide. I told her that I loved everything about that show, how it represented time spent with my mother, how it reminded me of myself as a young woman learning to love comedy, how when she took off her makeup and answered questions at the end of the show, it seemed like such a generous act because it made her feel like one of us. She said, and I quote, "Oh, Amy, you are my new best friend. It's in print, I swear." Isn't that right, Carol?
"Oh, Amy, you are my new best friend."
See? Oh, I cannot thank you enough for being here today.
Well, it's my pleasure.
A lot of people ask me if I always knew if I was going to be on Saturday Night Live. And I think the simple answer is yes. I don't mean to sound cocky. I didn't know if I had the talent or drive. I just had a tiny little voice whispering inside of me. The same voice that would tell me I would meet Carol Burnett one day. I would find love. I would be okay. We all have a tiny, whispery voice inside of us, but the bad ones are usually at a lower register and come through a lot clearer. I don't know where the good voice came from. It was a mix of loving parents, luck, and me. But ever since I was a small child, I would look at places where I wanted to be and believe I would eventually be on the other side of the glass. I believed that someday in the future, I would be rehearsing on stage at Saturday Night Live, while a gaggle of sophomore girls would be waving to me. All of them wearing cooler outfits than my classmates and I wore that day. My high school musical did not offer a shirtless Zac Efron, but it did provide me with many lessons. I learned that I loved being in a theater, attending rehearsals and building sets. I loved listening to the director and groaning about rehearsing choreography. When I would leave the bright sunlight of outside and enter the dark and empty theater, I would feel like a real artist with a true sense of purpose. Time passed and the world spun, but all that mattered was the thing in the room you were making together. I started going to theater parties and tried cigarettes. I'd floated into the right pool, finally. The play itself went well, from what I remember. It was a blur of adrenaline and costume changes, and I reveled in this new feeling of being incredibly stressed and pulling things off last minute. My parents rushed to congratulate me after the show. "You were so great, Ames," my mom said. "You don't have to go to college if you don't want to," my dad exclaimed. My mother hit him in the arm and told him he was crazy. This 1-2 punch of support and realism would help me deal with the many years of rejection I didn't know were ahead of me. I then thought about the idea of being an actress and tried it on for size. Back to fourth grade, The Wizard of Oz and Dorothy. I stood on stage in soft deer foam slippers. My mother had bought two pairs at Bradley's, and we spray painted them silver and sparkly red. My hair was braided, and I was wearing my own denim overall dress and blue checked blouse. It was time to speak during the tornado scene. All the other actors were supposed to be running around and reacting to heavy winds. A teacher made a whistling wind sound effect on a handheld microphone, and construction paper tumbleweeds were rolled across the stage. In my arms was Toto, played by a real dog. Some sucker had allowed us to cast their tiny poodle as Toto, which in hindsight begs the question, What kind of maniac hands over their tiny dog to a bunch of 10-year-olds for an elementary school play? We were in the second night of a blistering 2-night run. The previous evening, I had delivered my line, "Toto, Toto, where are you?" during the tornado scene, and the problem was the damn dog was in my arms at the time. The audience laughed. Lightning struck. And I discovered 3 important things. I liked getting a laugh. I wanted to get one again. But I wanted to get it in a different way and be in charge of how I got it. So I stood on stage that second night and tried something new. Trying something new was all I wanted to do when I graduated high school. I was so excited to go to Boston College that I distinctly remember wiggling in my seat as I wore my cap and gown. I wanted to go, go, go. Arriving at Boston College was like moving to a new country, and I was unprepared for the fact that most of the kids were a lot wealthier than me. I met prep school kids who knew how to decorate their rooms with tapestries. I became friends with private school athletes who were familiar with living away from home. I studied with foreign students who had their own credit cards. When I got the name of my new freshman roommate sent to me in the mail, I noticed she was from Illinois, and so I immediately assumed she lived on a farm. I was wrong. We spoke on the phone, and I asked her if classical music was playing in the background, and she informed me that was the sound of her doorbell. Her name was Erin, and she ended up being very nice and fun. We would sing the soundtrack to Les Misérables by the light of a neon beer sign that her dad had sent us to put in our dorm room window. I looked at my high hair and heard my New England accent and realized I was certainly bringing a lot of Boston to my Boston College experience. I decided I might want to tone down both my hair and the lazy R's for a while. I don't know, the accent is a really hard thing for me. It reminds me of my family and my childhood, but it's one of the worst sounding accents out there. I love Boston, but we sound like idiots. Our mouths never close, and we talk like big lazy babies. I might get shit for saying this, but as a true Bostonian, all I want to say to that is, fuck you, asshole. If you got a problem with me, then let's meet by the river. During my first week of freshman orientation, I went to a performance at the Eagle's Nest, a BC cafeteria and general social center. I was struck by how much fun it looked. It was ensemble comedy. It was improvisation. It was quick jokes and group mind dynamics. Everybody was getting to act and be funny and write and direct and edit all at the same time. The group was called My Mother's Fleabag, and it was the oldest running improvisational group on campus. I wanted in. I met Cara McNamara, one of the performers. She was a Boston girl and would eventually be my roommate, and she pushed me to audition, though I have no memory of actually doing it. I think it was mostly short-form improvisational games. I do remember that it was thrilling. I went back to my room and waited. We were told that we made the group by being woken up in the middle of the night and taken to a secret location to drink. It was like being hazed for one day, which is the exact amount of hazing I am able to withstand. We rehearsed constantly. We would spend hours arguing over one joke. Relationships were formed and trust was built. My Mother's Fleabag performed shows a couple of times a year. A cover band played Pulling Muscles from the Shell by Squeeze, and we would run out in baseball shirts. We did short-form improv games, sketches, and songs based on specific Boston College humor. It was fun, but not too cool. And it got me in front of an audience. I had a theater I went to every day and a group that needed me all the time. It was heaven. Cara and I moved in with a bunch of men and women off campus, and my college life sort of exploded in happiness. We used to host big and boozy parties. We had a goodbye to the 80s party, and everyone dressed in costume. At least 20 different women arrived in sexy Robert Palmer girl outfits. I dressed as Baby Jessica, the little girl that fell down the well, and was successfully rescued, important fact. I wore pajamas and pigtails and made my face a little dirty. Sexy stuff. We lived on a street called Strathmore, and our motto was, "Live more, love more, Strathmore." I learned about Charles Bush and Kate Bush. I sat with the cool Jesuit priests and talked about Edna St. Vincent Millay. I took classes like The Medium is the Message and The Male Lens. I carved out a pretty groovy off-campus curriculum in what was a very competitive academic program. I spent my days directing scenes from True West and my nights writing sketches about bad cafeteria food. I studied Shakespeare and I learned to control my voice. And at night, I huddled with a bunch of misfits and practiced being stupid on purpose. I didn't really know what kind of actor I wanted to be back then. I didn't really have a plan or even a mentor to follow. I just knew the things I didn't want. I didn't want to be tied down and stuck. I didn't want to decide who I was going to marry or where I was going to live. I took a public speaking class in college with Craig Finn, a friend of my cousin Lynn Sheehan, Gosling. Craig is a great musician who's now the lead singer of the band Hold Steady. And I remember feeling like we both knew a secret. We were going to keep performing no matter what, and we were both going to have no money, stability, or children for the next 10 years. I think we should stop asking people in their 20s what they want to do and start asking them what they don't want to do. Instead of asking students to declare their major, we should ask students to list what they will do anything to avoid. It just makes a lot more sense. I was in my off-campus Strathmore kitchen when Kara told me that she was going to move to Chicago after she graduated. She was a year ahead of me, and she'd heard about these classes at the comedy mecca Second City. Further investigation led us to research Improv Olympic, and they also had classes. And that settled it. Kara was going to Chicago and was going to get an apartment, and I would join her a year later. I can be a waitress anywhere, I said to my horrified parents, who had remortgaged their small house twice to pay for my brother and me to go to college. I started to believe in myself. I realized I could say whatever I wanted. In the second and final performance of The Wizard of Oz, I decided to take control during the tornado scene. I paused, put the blinking dog down on the stage, and walked a few feet away from it. Toto! Toto, where are you? I said, pretending to look for my lost dog in the fearsome storm. The dog froze and played it perfectly. I got laughter and some light applause for my efforts. I had improvised, and it had worked. One could argue that it worked because of the dog. A good straight dog can really help sell a joke, whatever. I've been chasing that high ever since. Plain Girl versus the Demon. I hate how I look. That is the mantra we repeat over and over again. Sometimes we whisper it quietly, and other times we shout it out loud in front of a mirror. I hate how I look. I hate how my face looks, my body looks. I am too fat or too skinny or too tall or too wide, or my legs are too stupid and my face is too smiley, or my teeth are dumb and my nose is serious and my stomach is being so lame. Then we think, I am so ungrateful. I have arms and legs and I can walk and I have strong nail beds and I am alive and I am so selfish and I have to read Man's Search for Meaning again and call my parents and volunteer more and reduce my carbon footprint. And why am I such a self-obsessed, ugly asshole? No wonder I hate how I look. I hate how I am. There have been 40 million books and billions of words written on this subject, so I will assume we are all caught up. That voice that talks badly to you is a demon voice. This very patient and determined demon shows up in your bedroom one day and refuses to leave. You are 6 or 12 or 15, and you look in the mirror and hear a voice so awful and mean that it takes your breath away. It tells you that you are fat and ugly and you don't deserve love. And the scary part is the demon is your own voice. But it doesn't sound like you. It sounds like a strangled and seductive version of you. Think Darth Vader mixed with a sexy Kathleen Turner. The good news is there are ways to make it stop talking. The bad news is it never goes away. If you're lucky, you can live a life where the demon is generally forgotten, relegated to a back shelf in a closet next to your old field hockey equipment. You may even have days or years when you think the demon is gone, but it is not. It is sitting very quietly, waiting for you. This motherfucker is patient. It says,
take your time.
It says,
go fall in love and exercise and surround yourself with people who make you feel beautiful.
It says,
don't worry, I'll wait.
And then one day you go through a breakup or you can't lose your baby weight or you look at your reflection in a soup spoon and that slimy bugger is back. It moves its sour mouth up to your ear and reminds you that you are fat and ugly and don't deserve love. This demon is some Stephen King from the sewer devil level shit. I had a lucky childhood. My demon didn't live in my room. My demon just walked around my neighborhood. I grew up with a naturally pretty but very earthy mother who never told me to put on makeup or change my outfit. I didn't have the kind of mother who flirted with my friends or wore tight jeans. In middle school, I was small and flat-chested, which is also a lucky break. You can kind of slip around unnoticed that way, which is exactly what you want. I was made fun of for being short, but it was mostly by boys who were shorter than me. I rarely brushed my hair, and I was skinny. I bordered on being a tomboy, but not enough to be labeled one. It was a wonderful but short-lived time when I was in my body, but not critical of it. If you ever want to see heaven, watch a bunch of young girls play. They're all sweat and skin knees, energy and open faces. My demon would receive my school picture and maybe gently suggest I
do something about those eyebrows.
But for the most part, it left me alone. I felt safe in the middle, a girl who had a perfectly fine face, but not one that drew any attention. Then I started caring about boys, and the demon pulled into my driveway. The 80s were a strange time for teenage fashion. We wore silk blouses and shoulder pads, neon earrings, and jodhpur pants. I mean, come to think of it, our pants were especially weird. We also wore stirrup pants, parachute pants, and velvet knickers. It was a real experimental pant time. We curled our hair and we sprayed it until it was crunchy and high. We wore jewel tones and too much makeup. With the exception of a few naturally beautiful girls who knew how to balance all of these elements, we looked ridiculous. Dating in middle school often meant walking around the mall together and spending hours on your phone picking your song. There was some light handholding and maybe a kiss on the cheek, but it was really all very innocent. I dated one boy, and our song was Faithfully by Journey. Every time it played, my body would turn electric, and I would stare out whatever window I was near and reminisce about experiences I hadn't had. Is there a word for when you're young and pretending to have lived and loved a thousand lives? Is there a German word for that? It seems like there should be. Let's say it's Schaufenfrugelsbloit. Dating in high school was very different. Boys suddenly went up your shirt. Girls were expected to give blowjobs and be sexy. You had to be hot, but not a slut. You had to be into sex, but never have it, except when your boyfriend wanted it. If you had sex, you had to keep it a secret, but also be very good at it, except not too good, because this better be your first time. Darling Nikki masturbated to a magazine, but Madonna was supposedly still a virgin. It was very confusing. Once high school started, I began to see the real difference between the plain and the pretty. Boys who were going through their own battles started to point out things about me I hadn't yet noticed. One told me I looked like a frog. Some told me I smiled like a Muppet. A senior told me to stop looking at him with my big, weird eyes. I looked in the mirror at my flat chest and my freckles, and I heard a sound. It was the demon, suitcase in hand. He moved in and demanded the top bunk. Now, as I continue, please know a few things. I usually find any discussion about my own looks to be incredibly boring. I can only imagine what a yawn fest it is for you. But I cannot, in good faith, pretend I have fallen in love with how I look. The demon still visits me often. I wish I could tell you that being on television or having a nice picture in a magazine suddenly washes all of those thoughts away, but it really doesn't. I wish I were taller or had leaner hands and a less crazy smile. I don't like my legs, especially. I used to have a terrific flat stomach, but now it's kind of blown out after two giant babies use it as a short-term apartment. My nose is great. My tits are better than ever. I like my giant eyes, but they can get crazy. My ass is pretty sweet. My hair is too thin for my liking. My Irish and English heritage and my early sun exposure guarantee that I am on the fast track to Wrinkle City. Bored yet? Because I can't stop. I went through high school and college and the years after, dating all different types of people. I think if you line them up in a row, there would not be one single physical characteristic that they all shared. Most were white, not all. Some were short and hairy. Some were weird, some pretty, sweet, athletic. I would say that maybe most of the men I had dated had a small current of anger fueling them. But that's the case for most funny people. I dated a lot of really funny people, and some medium funny. The best-looking ones were medium funny at best. It's tough to be both. In Chicago, I dated a male model for a hot minute. It was the first time I had dated someone that handsome, but the truth was he was in my improv class and not that funny, so I felt weirdly superior. I made the mistake of snooping and reading the model's journal. We finished having medium to boring sex, and I rifled through his things while he took a shower. I'm pretty good at snooping around. It started in my own house, where I would go through every drawer and every pocket in my parents' room. Luckily, I didn't find much at home, except for some well-worn copies of Playboy that seem positively charming compared to the up-close butt-fisting that pops up on my computer these days when I'm trying to order salad tongs from Target. I honed my snooping skills when I babysat. It was then that I saw my first diaphragm, laxatives, and stacks of cash in an underwear drawer. I've basically ransacked every house I've been allowed into. My snooping tendencies have now abated somewhat, but I still have to fight the urge to immediately go through people's shit. I am not proud of this, and I realize that by admitting this, I am limiting future opportunities to be a house guest. Anyway, the bad part about snooping is you can find stuff you don't want to find. Snooping in emails, texts, or journals is a disaster. No one says good things about people in diaries. You tell people the good things. Diaries are for the bad things. I found an entry from Model Man that basically said he was kind of proud of himself for dating someone like me. He thought I was funny, but not that pretty, which was kind of like cool, you know? He, like, wasn't into me, but, like, was totally down for the journey. Like, cool man. And I remember thinking, ha ha, I know that already, dummy. We just had boring sex and I win because I tricked you with my personality. I don't even like you. And then I went home and I cried and I took way too long to break up with him. But I was eventually okay. And you will be okay too. And here's why. I had already made a decision early on that I would be a plain girl with tons of personality, and accepting it made everything a lot easier. If you're lucky, there's a moment in your life where you have some say as to what your currency is going to be. I decided early on it was not going to be my looks. I've spent a lifetime coming to terms with this idea, and I would say I'm about 15 to 20% there, which I think is great progress. Look, I'm not underestimating the access I get as a blonde white lady from America. Believe me, blonde hair can take you really far. Especially with the older men, it can really distract from the face. I am convinced I could have had sex with both Tony Bennett and John McCain if we weren't each happily married at the time we all met. Decide what your currency is early. Let go of what you will never have. People who do this are happier and sexier. Being considered beautiful can be tough. I know this because I work in Hollywood, which is filled with the most conventionally beautiful people in the world. Beautiful people can get objectified and underestimated. They didn't do anything to earn their genes, so they have to struggle to prove that they are more than their hot bods. People assume they're happy and good in bed, and most times this is not true. Plus, beautiful people get a little addicted to being told they are beautiful, and they have real trouble when they get older, get less attention, or have their spouse cheat on them with someone considered plain. Improvisation and sketch comedy helped me find my currency. My plain face was a perfect canvas to be other people. There's nothing I like more than picking out wardrobe for a character. An SNL hairstylist once told me I had a great face for wigs. A great face for wigs. What a compliment! And also the title of my second book. Looking silly can be very powerful. People who are committing and taking risks become the king and queen of my prom. People are their most beautiful when they're laughing, crying, dancing, playing, telling the truth, and being chased in a fun way. Improvisation and sketch comedy let me choose who I wanted to be. I didn't audition to play the sexy girl. I just played her. I got to cast myself. I cast myself as sexy girls, old men, rock stars, millionaire perverts, and rodeo clowns. I played werewolves and Italian prostitutes and bitchy cheerleaders. I was never too this or not enough that. Every week on SNL, I had the opportunity to write whatever I wanted, and then I was allowed to read it, and people had to listen. And once in a blue moon, it got on TV, and maybe 5 times it was something really good. Writing gave me an incredible amount of power, and my currency became what I wrote and said and did. If you write a scene for yourself, you can say in the stage directions, "The most beautiful woman in the world enters the bar and all the men and women turn their heads." And then you can write a scene where you say, "Sergio, the most gorgeous man we have ever seen, starts to kiss her." And if you're lucky enough to be directing the scene, you can have casting sessions and bring in various attractive men and see if they're good at kissing you. You will arrive on set, and the call sheet at the start of the day can read, "Jasmine has sex with Sergio in a rowboat." And then you go have fake sex with someone and still not cheat on anybody. Men do this all the time. Acting isn't all bad. Hopefully, as you get older, you start to learn how to live with your demon. It's hard at first. Some people give their demon so much room that there's no space in their head or bed for love. They feed their demon, and it gets really strong, and then it makes them stay in abusive relationships or starve their beautiful bodies. But sometimes you get a little older, and you get a little bored of the demon. Through good therapy and friends and self-love, you can practice treating the demon like a hacky, annoying cousin. Maybe a day even comes when you're getting dressed for a fancy event and it whispers,
"You aren't pretty."
And you go, "I know, I know. Now let me find my earrings." Sometimes you say, "Demon, I promise you, I will let you remind me of my ugliness, but right now I'm having hot sex, so I'll check in later." Other times, I take a more direct approach. When the demon starts to slither my way and say bad shit about me, I turn around and say, "Hey, cool it. Amy is my friend. Don't talk about her like that." Sticking up for ourselves in the same way we would one of our friends is a hard but satisfying thing to do. Sometimes it works. Even demons gotta sleep. Like, who likes you? Let's take a break and sip a little tea, shall we? Oh, now it's time for Patrick Stewart to read something.
But of course.
Sir?
Hello, Amy. It is truly my pleasure. Plastic surgery haiku. If you plump your lips, the words that come out of them sound ridiculous. We know it's Botox and not your vegan diet. Nice try, Margaret. A facelift does not make daughters comfortable when you chaperone. Fine, get your boobs done, but only make them smaller. Fake boobs are weird, y'all. Asymmetrical looks cool, while cheek implants are less interesting. Plastic surgery requires a good amount of lying to friends. Can I be honest? You look like a lady from the Broadway show Cats.
I have no idea if you're angry or sad since you got fillers.
Hey, shooting poison in your face does not keep you from turning 50.
Laughing to crying to laughing. Doing sketch comedy on live television while pregnant is like wearing a sombrero. You can pretend to be a serious person, but the giant hat gives you away. I have spent an inordinate amount of time on camera being pregnant. Sometimes it was real, and sometimes it was not. When I shot the film Baby Mama, I wore a fake belly. It was shaped like a watermelon cut in half, and it was strapped onto my body with flesh-colored Velcro. I would adjust it to where it felt comfortable and then giggle at the sight of it under my clothes. I would rip my belly off at lunch, and the satisfying Velcro rip would announce that my pregnancy was over. Many times I patted my sweaty and firm stomach and thought about how cool it was going to be when I really was pregnant. Real pregnancy is different. I always wanted to have kids. I like them. They like me. I'm a mother now, and I think I'm pretty good at it. I think I'm a decent person and a very good listener and excellent at funny faces, all necessary when mothering a child. When I was 26, a Japanese healer felt my abdomen and told me I had a joyful uterus and I would have 3 children. He worked in a dusty office that smelled like envelope glue. He gave me a bunch of herbs to help with my anxiety, which is why I was actually there. But when I boiled the herbs, the smell was so horrible that I became instantly anxious at the thought of ingesting them and threw them in the garbage. In addition to my joyful uterus, I have what my Nana referred to as her Irish stomach. This means that when I get old, I should limit myself to buttered saltine crackers and the occasional hot dog. I associate hot dogs with the very young and the very old. Once, after a grueling rehearsal at SNL for a Mother's Day show, where I was 6 months pregnant with my second son, I asked the indefatigable Betty White what she was going to do when she got home. She told me she was going to fix herself a vodka on the rocks and eat a cold hot dog. In one sentence, she proved my theory and made me excited for my own future. Most of my 30s were spent married and without children, which is a state of affairs that I would highly recommend most people try for a while. Married and without children means you can go on vacations with other childless couples. You can eat in any restaurant at any time and have conversations about interesting things. You can decide to learn how to surf or write a slim book on the best place to buy a fedora in Los Angeles because your spouse will be supportive and no one has to go home to relieve the babysitter. I was in no rush to change this wonderful lifestyle. Then I woke up and realized I was 37 and might need to get cracking. Pregnancy is such a sensitive and subjective experience. Trying to get pregnant is the most vulnerable thing in the world. You have to openly decide you are ready, and then you have to put sperm in your vagina and elevate your legs like you're an upside-down coffee table. It's all ridiculous and incredibly sci-fi. Everyone's journey is different, and I have nothing to say about how and when someone decides to become a mother. The legacy of my generation will be that we have truly expanded the idea of what family means. It is no longer unusual for people who choose surrogacy, gay adoption, IVF, international and domestic adoption, fostering, and childlessness to live side by side and quietly judge each other. We can all live in peace, thinking our way is the best way and everything else is cuckoo. I was lucky. I tried for a little while to get pregnant, and at 37, I did. I didn't tell anyone at first, as you are supposed to keep it secret. It's a really magical time, those first few weeks. It almost makes you wish you didn't have to tell anyone ever. You could just watch your belly grow bigger, and no one would be allowed to ask you about it, and you would have your baby, and a year later, you would allow visitors to finally come and meet your little miracle. I was halfway through my 7th season at SNL, and no one really noticed my nausea or extreme tiredness. This was par for the course at a job that made you stay up all night long and eat cold mozzarella sticks you had to buy yourself. My OBGYN was a wonderfully old Italian man I will call Dr. G. Dr. G had delivered Sophia Loren's children. I know this because everyone from his receptionist to the other doctors in his practice liked to tell me this fact. I was happy to hear that Dr. G was comfortable with beautiful and famous vaginas. I don't consider myself beautiful or famous, but my vagina certainly is. Everyone knows this. I have the Angelina Jolie of vaginas. And there is your pull quote, editors. But even with my glamorous vagina, I worried about delivery. I have many friends who have had natural childbirth. I applaud them. I have friends who have used doulas and birthing balls and pushed out babies in tubs and taxi cabs. I have a friend who had two babies at home, in bed. Her name is Maya Rudolph. She's a goddamn baby champion, and she pushed her cuties out Little House on the Prairie style. Good for her. Not for me. That is the motto women should constantly repeat over and over again. Good for her, not for me. I knew early on that my big-headed babies were going to be tricky to get out of my 5'2" frame. I knew that I was worried about pain and wanted to have the right measures in place. I knew I was the kind of person who could barely go to the movies without being stoned, let alone a delivery room. I remember a very important day when I told my dentist I wanted nitrous oxide at the ready every time I came in for an appointment. No matter the procedure, no questions asked. This is what adults do. They demand or deny drugs on their own terms. Luckily, Dr. G made me feel like I'd be able to handle anything. Dr. G was European and old-fashioned in all the right ways. He reassured me I didn't need an amniocentesis by reminding me that Italian women don't worry about that sort of thing. I imagined Sophia Loren laughing off the idea of a needle being driven into her pregnant belly as she sipped an espresso. Dr. G dressed in stylish suits and moved very gently, squirting cold gel on my tummy while whistling a slow tune. He didn't have a 3D imaging machine. He had a utilitarian black-and-white deal that